You're listening to KSCO, Santa Cruz, Salinas, Monterey, and San Jose, and 104 FM. This is From the Bookshelf. I'm Gary Shapiro. Thanks for joining me.
Peter Melman is my guest. He's the author of the novels Hashtag Me As Well and It Won't Always Be This Great, and a book of essays called Mandela Was Late. He's also a television producer and a writer whose work on Seinfeld was very memorable, to say the least, and yada, 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 he's here now. Peter Melman, welcome to From the Bookshelf.
Thanks. Great to be here.
So your new novel, do you say hashtag me as well? Is that how you say it?
Yes.
It's pretty hilarious, but it's also very serious, and I don't like to give stuff away. So I'll let you tell us a little bit about it.
Well, it's about a Pulitzer Prize-winning sports writer who makes one slightly off-color, questionably sexist joke that goes viral, and he's just saying it amongst a group of sports writer friends, and someone posted it on Instagram, and he finds himself in the middle of, you know, one of these Me Too storms, and it just kind of locked into some of my obsessions in life, which is, you know, all the hypocrisy of sports, not to mention the kind of craziness of the whole Me Too movement and the ups and downs of that movement. And also the thing that most fascinated me is just like the minute-to-minute life of somebody who's caught up in this. You know, like I'm always like wondering, like, can Matt Lauer even go to lunch? You know, can Louis C.K. walk down the street? You know, can Charlie Rose, you know, go to his dentist? You know, these things are just fascinating to me. So that's what the book really is about.
So is it autobiographical to some degree?
It is not the least bit autobiographical. In a way, well, I shouldn't say that. In a way, you know, I was a sports writer for the Washington Post, and I think the main character, Arnie Pepper, is kind of where I would be now if I had, you know, followed the normal path of a sports writer at the Washington Post and, you know, started covering, you know, the Washington Redskins and college football games and the Super Bowl and ultimately become a columnist. The Pulitzer Prize winning part, that's, you know, very optimistic.
Well, so do you what are your feelings? Do you feel like the Me Too movement has reached too far?
I don't think it's actually reached too far. I mean, you know, there's always, when it comes to movements like this, there's always going to be extremes of it. And there are and have been some examples where it's gone a little over the top. I mean, most notably Al Franken. You know, that's an opinion, but I think it's shared by a lot of people that, you know, he's a comedian and I don't know. It just doesn't seem like he should have lost his Senate seat. But back to your question, you know, I think the Me Too movement is 95% positive, you know, and there's always going to be that tiny shred of fanaticism that grows out of a movement where certain people might get victimized. You know, maybe just the degree of oversensitivity. But, you know, for the most part, I think the Me Too movement has actually been quite constructive.
Are you afraid that people might misinterpret your novel as being an anti-Me Too movement kind of thing?
I am not afraid of it. In fact, I kind of assume that there will be some people who read it who interpret it that way. And that's the way I wanted it. You know, I wanted some people to kind of agree with whatever thesis there is in there and some people to be offended by it. You know, I think that, you know, I don't think I was taking any particular stand on it in the book. I was just trying to be very well-rounded about it and just to be deeply inside the head of this one person who's been caught up in the movement.
Has political correctness made comedy more difficult?
Political correctness correctness has made comedy almost impossible. I mean, I have to tell you that recently I was walking in Santa Monica with my dog, and a woman comes out of a store, and she falls in love with my dog. She's playing with it and everything, and then she says, "Did you adopt this dog?" And I said, "No, he's my biological dog." And she looks up at me, and she says, "Hey, if you ever went to a kill shelter, you wouldn't think you're so funny." Now, when you can't make a dog joke anymore, you know that comedy is in rough shape.
When you think back on some of the things that you did on Seinfeld, were there things that you couldn't possibly do now that you did then?
I think Seinfeld would have lost like 50 jokes a week. You know, I mean, you know, we did some stuff that was pretty offensive by today's standards. So, I think along with all the other incredible strokes of luck that happened to make Seinfeld as successful as it was, one of those was that it took place in the 90s when, you know, people had a little bit more of a sense of humor about things.
A less enlightened time.
Yeah, I don't know. I don't know if it's enlightenment or sensitivity or what. You know, I mean, sometimes I just think that everybody should be forced to sit down and watch, you know, Blazing Saddles and Airplane, you know, and they're so funny and so ecumenical in their humor about everyone and everything that, you know, maybe we'd all just lighten up a little bit.
Yeah, you know, when you start viewing things through our current enlightened eyes, you look at Harpo Marx chasing women around, and it's like, oh my gosh, that's not funny.
Yeah. I mean, you know, imagine the first scene in Arthur when he stops the limousine and, you know, kind of approaches these two prostitutes, and, you know, it's like, "Will the better looking of the two of you please step forward?" And, you know, and then there's just the unbelievable joke of, you know, she says, "So tell me about yourself, Gloria," you know, to the prostitute, and she goes, "Oh, you mean why I'm a hooker?" And he goes, "You're a hooker? I thought I was just doing great with you." And then she goes, "You know, my mother died." I think it was, she says, "My mother died when I was 6, and my father raped me when I was 12. And Arthur says, "So you had 6 relatively good years there." I mean, you know, that is just, forget that happening now. I mean, God, could you imagine? The world would explode.
And think of all the comedians that made a career when we were kids of pretending to be drunk. I mean, not just Dean Martin, but there was Foster Brooks and the guy on the Jackie Gleason show, Crazy Guggenheim.
Yeah, well, I don't know. I think we would have been denied a lot of laughs in our lives. I don't know. It's, you know, everything has, you know, everything just has its equal and opposite bad side to it. You know, it's like the internet. You know, for every good thing about it, there's the equal and opposite nightmare. And, you know, I think that's kind of a microcosm of the world we're living in now.
Yeah, I guess that you could say it about all technology. As technology grows, we get these great things and these awful things in equal amounts.
Yeah, I used to think it was equal amounts. Now I think the awful things are kind of outweighing them by like 3-1. But, you know, I'm old, so, you know, the whole technological thing is just mostly annoying to me. It's almost like, you know, everything in the world now seems to be dedicated to keeping you in your house and never leaving. You know, Amazon is keeping you from ever going to stores. Streaming is keeping you from ever going to the movies. You know, and social media is keeping you from ever meeting friends. I don't know, you know, it's like everybody is just kind of holed up.
Well, you also wrote a book of essays called Peter Melman's called Mandela Was Late. You probably knew that. I didn't need to tell you that, but my listeners might not know. And in there, you talk a little bit about, you know, wanting to travel is not one of your favorite things.
No, I don't really like travel. I just feel like life has so much more potential when you're home. All these good things can happen when you're home and working and going about your normal life, and then, you know, you go off to Italy and you're walking in a bunch of churches and it's everything, museums and buying leather goods, and, you know, it's nice for a couple of days, but, you know, after that, I'm, like, itching just to get back to my normal life. And then the other thing that's always amazing to me now is that people travel to these exotic locations, and all they come back talking about is the food. You know, like, yeah, I went on a safari in Uganda, and the place we stayed at was amazing, and the food was incredible. Like, that's it? The food? I mean, you live in Los Angeles, or you live in New York, or you live in any major city, and there's so many great restaurants, you don't need to spend $8,000 and sit in an airplane for 15 hours to get good food. It's right here.
The airplane is the hardest part.
Oh, God. You know, I went to, boy, speaking of politically incorrect, I went to Vietnam on vacation, and, God, you fly to Tokyo, and you think, boy, what a haul. And then the next leg of the trip is 5.5 hours, you know, which is basically New York to L.A. And like, oh, my God, this is that part of the world is so big. And, you know, I kept on making this joke about, you know, I was, like, after 3 days in Vietnam, I was making this joke about how I didn't understand why all those Vietnam vets were whining about Vietnam. I was having such a great time.
And the food was amazing.
And the food was amazing. Actually, I didn't think the food was that good, to tell you the truth. I'm sure it's better now.
I'm Gary Shapiro. This is From the Bookshelf on KSCO, and we're talking with Peter Melman. He's a novelist whose new book is called Hashtag Me As Well. He also was one of the writers of Seinfeld. Peter Melman, you worked for the great sportscaster Howard Cosell. Was that your first job in television?
Yes.
Dave Kindred, the sports writer, was on the show here. He wrote a book about Howard Cosell, and he considered him to be, you know, a great pioneer in sports journalism and a heroic character. And how did you find Cosell?
You know, the funny thing is, I had been at the Washington Post, and when I sent in a resume to get on Howard's show, Sports Beat, I listed a bunch of references, and Howard did not call any of them. He called Dave Kindred to ask about me. And, you know, that's how I got the job. I thought Howard Cosell was everything that Dave Kindred described. I think he was the most important sports media figure ever. And nobody has really taken up the mantle of, you know, being both an entertainer on sports broadcasts and doing sports journalism. I think Brian Gumbel does a really good job on his HBO show, which is kind of a similar show to what Howard did on Sports Beat. But, you know, it's just amazing to me that nobody ever really went after Cosell in that way, you know, like his model. You know, you see the color commentators on football games now, all they talk about is football. You know, the game is like 37-3, and they're still talking about what the defense is doing and whether they're in a cover two. You know, this is time for you to just talk about life and philosophy that fits into sports. And, you know, the one thing that Howard Cosell did that used to annoy people is he would not let you sit in that Camelot world of sports and let you sit on your couch and think that this is not connected to real life, because sports is intimately connected to real life. And, you know, if there's the same social structures in sports, there's this, the money aspect of it is as American as it gets. And nobody talks about that. I'm just amazed at, like, what the announcers are like these days. You know, just if you can say a bunch of sports terms, you could say a bunch of, like, football defensive stuff, they consider you to just be a great announcer. But, you know, people like Cosell and, you know, to a very large degree, John Madden, you know, you had this feeling of some kind of depth, of some kind of feeling that these people know about the world and they have their priorities straight. Like, this game is not as important as everybody is making it out to be. It's just a game. But there are people playing this game, and, you know, you look at the NFL and, you know, these guys are getting this traumatic head injuries and everything like that, and nobody wants to hear about that stuff, you know? Nobody wants anything beyond, you know, Pat Mahomes is 15 of 20, but he's only throwing for 6 yards per completion. You know, like, who cares about this stuff? But I think that's the influence that Howard Cosell had on me, you know, just seeing constant hypocrisy in the world of sports and not being able to just thoroughly absorb myself in a game.
So you were working at the Washington Post when you went to work for Howard Cosell?
I was working at the Washington Post, and then for a whole bunch of immature reasons I won't go into, I moved back to New York, and you know, for a while I was just sending out resumes, and I finally got the job with Sportsbeat.
And what was your job, and what was your interaction with Howard Cosell?
Well, we had a very small staff. It was about 8 people. And so I would do everything from writing a script for Howard's voiceover to programming the Chirons. You know, I got to experience everything that you do in TV production, which was fantastic. We were very tight little unit, so I was, you know, around Howard constantly, and you know, and thrillingly the butt of many of his incredibly funny jokes. You know, I mean, he was really, really funny. I always would kid Jerry Seinfeld that he was the second funniest boss I ever had. But Howard was, you know, hysterical, and he did incredible practical jokes and things like that, you know, calling you at 6 a.m. in the morning on, you know, on a Sunday just to make some joke and then hang up.
Did he wear his toupee around the office?
Oh, yeah. But the funny thing is, I had been there maybe 6 months, and one day I come into the office, and I noticed that Howard's assistant, as soon as I came in, picked up the phone and went into her intercom to Howard and said something. And 2 seconds later, I hear Howard's voice going, "Melman, come on in here a second." And I walk over, and Howard's without his toupee. He was having it cleaned. But he just called me in to see what my reaction would be to seeing him without his toupee. And I just looked at him. I said, new look, Howard? And he just goes, And he goes, he'd laugh like that, and they go, "Okay, get out of here." But, you know, he would constantly be testing your sense of humor. You know, the funny thing is, once he had Harry Edwards, I don't know if you know who that is. Harry Edwards was the guy who basically organized the Olympic boycott in 1968. he was about 6'8", black man with, you know, a shaved head and very imposing looking and a brilliant man, a professor at Berkeley, I believe. And Howard called me into his office one day, and Harry Edwards was there, and he says to me, "Peter, what do you think about black coaches in the NFL? And I knew that Howard was wanting me to say something funny. So I said, "I don't know. There seem to be plenty of black players, so they have to coach too." And Howard goes, "That's an excellent point, Peter." Harry Edwards is looking at us like we're both crazy, and then Howard breaks up laughing, and I break up laughing, and then Harry Edwards got the joke, and he was hysterical. So those were the kind of great moments in the world of Howard Cosell.
So did you go directly to working on Seinfeld, or what was your television experience after that?
No, after the 84 Olympics, there were massive layoffs at ABC. I mean, the corporate waste at the Olympics was beyond belief, off the charts, and eventually they had to make big cuts. And as I said, we had a very small staff, and there were, I think, two or three of us. You know, I was still amongst the three, you know, least tenured people at the show, so I was laid off in December of 84, a few months after the Olympics, and then I wasn't sure what I was going to do, and I started, one day I just was sitting at home and I wrote this article called "The We Just Broke Up Last Night Diet," and I sent it into Mademoiselle magazine, and they bought it, and they ran it. And I was thinking, wow, this is really fun. I could sit at home and just write articles. So for about 4 or 5 years, I was just a freelance magazine writer in New York. I was writing for, you know, GQ and all these women's magazines and the New York Times magazine. And then I moved to Los Angeles for kind of like a little bit of a change of life. And I bumped into Larry David on the street in 1990. And I had met him in New York like once or twice, and he just said, "Hey, you know, I'm doing this little show with Jerry Seinfeld. Maybe you could write a script for us." You know, and he asked me for a writing sample. And of course, I had never written dialogue before, so I gave him this essay that I had written in the New York Times. It was kind of funny, but it was also bittersweet. And he sent it on to Jerry, and Jerry took a shine to it, and I got a chance to write a script, and somehow I lucked out, and with, you know, beginner's luck, and they really liked the script, and I don't know, next thing you know, I was loaded.
You're like a producer on the show, because I see your name there on the credits.
So, yeah, I kind of, title-wise, I kind of worked my way up, you know, year by year, you would get a higher title, which didn't necessarily mean there was much of a difference in what you were doing. It was basically all about coming up with ideas for episodes and writing episodes. You know, you just tried to get as many shows on the air as possible. So, you know, you were just sitting in your office trying to come up with another Kramer idea all the time. It was really almost kind of competitive and, you know, really difficult, especially for me, having come from a journalism background where I was looking out at the world and reporting on it. Suddenly, I was just making up the world, you know, making up events and what would happen. And, you know, that was very difficult for me. And, you know, learning to be creative was a struggle that I went through the entire 6-7 years that I was working at Seinfeld. And in a way, to this day, I'm still, you know, wrestling with how to be creative, how to bring creativity out of myself. And, you know, so in a way, Seinfeld really kind of opened up a whole new avenue in my life.
Do you think the fact that this show was so famously a show about nothing made it more difficult to write? That, in other words, you know, you couldn't say, okay, well, Gilligan and Ginger, you know, I mean, if you had a sitcom that had a premise,
then you can always write based on the premise, whereas there's no real premise in Seinfeld, and that made it harder to write for it?
To tell you the truth, I totally disagree with the whole concept of the show about nothing. You know, that was one episode where they're pitching a show about nothing, but, you know, if you look at Seinfeld, the show is about everything. You know, it was about social manners. It was about little slices of life that happened to just about everybody. And if you look even closer, the show took on pretty much every issue there is. You know, it kind of took on abortion. It took on homophobia. You know, it just really hit on everything. I mean, you know, every other show to me, you know, popular shows of that time, you know, Frasier and Friends, those were shows about nothing. You know, those were shows that were about the cast members and their immediate orbit of people, but they didn't really go into worldwide issues, you know, especially if you look at Friends. I mean, you know, beyond Jennifer Aniston's hair, there's absolutely no impact on the cultural landscape of America there. You know, on Seinfeld, you actually had the opportunity to, you know, put out those expressions that became part of society, you know, not that there's anything wrong with it, or, you know, master of my domain, or any of those things. You know, so I really kind of always thought that the whole show about nothing thing was disingenuous and kind of pointed in the wrong direction of what the show was really about.
I'm Gary Shapiro. This is From the Bookshelf on KSCO, and we're talking this week with Peter Melman. He's one of the writers of the famous sitcom Seinfeld, and he's also written a couple of novels, and his newest is called Hashtag Me As Well. Peter Melman, before the break, you were saying that Seinfeld was not truly a show about nothing, but a show about everything. Did you look for social issues to write about, or did they just come up naturally?
They just came up naturally. You know, like, I had this story in the episode called The Sponge. You know, I had this story that Jerry got a girl's phone number off an AIDS walk list, you know, which was pretty bad in itself. But then you go, wait, now that we have the AIDS walk as part of the story, you know, what could we deal with there? And we have an aspect of it where Kramer refuses to wear the AIDS ribbon, which was, you know, a thing like we were going to the Emmys every year, and as you're walking in, they're giving you the AIDS ribbon. And, you know, you're like, okay, I'll wear the AIDS ribbon, you know, like it, which always struck pretty much everybody on the show as, you know, a gesture that was nice, but it's really at the point where after you've done it for 3 or 4 years, you start feeling like, I'm not really doing anything, you know, to help people stricken with AIDS. I'm just wearing this ribbon and it's making me feel like I'm doing something positive, but really, you know, you're not really contributing.
Did you ever change the waist number on your Levi's?
No. that was a Jerry idea.
Isn't that in that same episode, if I'm not mistaken?
That is in that same episode. You have a very good memory. I actually kind of forgot about that aspect, but yeah, that's the that's the one thing she was offended by. You know, the girl wasn't offended that Jerry had gotten her phone number off an AIDS list, but when she found out that he changed the size number on his Levi's, that was what ended the relationship.
You know, like the straw that broke the camel's back.
Yeah, I mean, you know, which is another thing, you know, about the show is that there were so many misplaced priorities. You know, people are just so unpredictable and strange, you know, that, and another thing about it is that nothing ever worked out well. You know, at the end of every episode, everything would pretty much have gone to hell, And then the next week, they're back together again as best of friends, ready to kind of screw each other over again. You know, they were constantly ruining each other's lives, or whatever they were up to that week, they were kind of screwing each other over. You know, these were not great people. And yet the next week, there they were, back in the coffee shop, you know, in their own little bubble, thinking that everybody else in the world was crazy and they were the sane ones.
Were there comedy shows that you watched when you were younger that you would say were an influence on your comedy style?
I would say no. You know, I wasn't much of a sitcom watcher. I loved Get Smart when I was a kid. And I watched All in the Family. That was really great. And, you know, I watched a little Mary Tyler Moore, but, you know, I wasn't really a showbiz kid. You know, I wasn't that interested in that stuff. And I can't, you know, obviously Woody Allen's just a huge influence. But other than that, I can't really point to much, especially as far as TV. You know, there are so few sitcoms that I actually watched. You know, I liked Taxi a lot. But, you know, like even Cheers, while it was kind of funny, I don't know, it just didn't grab me. But Taxi had a real undercurrent of sadness because all these people were cab drivers. And
what a miserable existence that would be.
Yeah, I mean, you know, and they're in that awful cab place, you know, the cab garage, and, you know, they all have these dreams that you kind of know are never going to come true. And, you know, there was something about it, that undercurrent, that made it such a great show. I always thought that was, like, the most underrated of shows. And, you know, All in the Family had a huge impact on the culture. And I think that one had some influence on me because, you know, the thing I liked most about Seinfeld is that you had the opportunity to affect the culture of America. You know, you could change the lexicon. You could have people look at things in different ways. And, you know, without that, I don't even see the point of writing a show just to get out a whole bunch of funny lines, you know. I don't know.
But then you did go on and write some other TV, yeah?
Yes, I did a show for DreamWorks called It's Like You Know, which was, some people thought it was kind of the West Coast version of Seinfeld, and I think that was just because it was me and, you know, when I had been with Seinfeld. But, you know, it was a pretty fascinating and eye-opening experience to do another show. You know, it made you realize how unrealistic your life was when you were on Seinfeld because, you know, there was no network interference. You could and once you could do a show 22 minutes about masturbation, you could pretty much get away with anything. And then, you know, you go to a different network and you start your own show, and it's like going back to square one where, you know, they're telling you, gee, you know, the character's not that all likable, not really that likable. I'm like, like, what did you think you were getting when you went into business with me? You know, what was especially eye-opening is that I realized that network executives hated Seinfeld. They liked it as fans, but as executives, they hated it because it broke all the rules. The characters were not likable. The stories were very, you know, tiny and, you know, real inside and minuscule bits of American life. And, you know, they just hated all of that. And, you know, I was kind of trying to do a similar thing and add my own angles to it with my show, It's Like You Know. And it was very difficult. It was a constant struggle with the network to, you know, say, this is okay. You know, I did a whole episode where all the characters are just sitting at home watching a high-speed chase on TV. which is what L.A. does. You know, there's a chase on TV, the whole town closes down, and you just sit and watch the chase. And they were like, no, that's not a show. And I said, and I would say, Seinfeld did an entire show sitting at, in the front of a Chinese restaurant. And they go, that was Seinfeld. This isn't Seinfeld. I said, yeah, but philosophically it is. And, it was just an incredible struggle.
So after that, did you, said, that's it, I'm never doing television again, or?
No, I mean, I had 2-3 year deals with DreamWorks, and I did a few other pilots, and somehow, and, Jeffrey Katzenberg, God bless him, he encouraged me to be as creative as I could possibly be, to really take chances. And, I did. I did one pilot about, that I described as sitcom noir. It was kind of a combination of Airplane and Twin Peaks. It was really dark. It was really funny and kind of surreal. And, for a while there was a network that absolutely loved it and they were on board. And then all of a sudden they kind of chickened out. They called me in and said, so what do you think is going to happen in episode, say, 18? And I said, I don't know what's going to happen in episode 3. I know the show has to continue to be funny and interesting, but I don't know what's going to happen. Boom. No, they dropped out.
That was the wrong answer.
That was totally the wrong answer.
Yeah.
But I had no idea how, you write a pilot and then you're supposed to know what's going to happen 17 episodes later. Nobody knows that, and that's not the creative process. The creative process is you figure out what's next, in episode 2, and then, crazy things happen, things occur that change the course of the entire show, or you get some actor in the show who's so funny or so good that suddenly that character becomes a prime player. Like Lilith in Cheers, Bebe Neuwirth was supposed to be in one episode, but she was so good she ended up being a main character in the show. And that happens. It's all unpredictable. You can't, legislate creativity. Things just take their own turns, that you're powerless to stop. And, like in Seinfeld, Wayne Knight as Newman, he was so funny that he became a guy who was in, maybe 13 of the 22 episodes per season, just because he was so great. So you never know what's going to happen. You can never know what's going to happen in episode 18.
Jaime the robot. But if you have a show like Twin Peaks, you kind of hope, or like Lost or one of those, you sort of hope that the guys who are writing it know the answer, or otherwise they're just leading you around.
Yeah, well, they just, there's a conflict between, a writer and an executives, because the creative process is kind of like driving at night, where you could see as far as the headlights take you, and you could have ultimately get to your destination that way, but you don't really see all the way from, in this case, episode 1 to episode 22. So the network wants to know what's going to happen, and, it's ridiculous for you to have to tell them some kind of answer that's going to make them feel safe about the project. So, it's really difficult, and from what I hear, it's gotten much, much more difficult.
So writing a novel, you're in charge. You're in charge of every page.
Yeah, it's a beautiful thing. It really is. I mean, it's such a pleasure to have kind of no one staring over your shoulder and just, you know, finding your own creative way of figuring out a story. And then, in a way, it becomes a little bit like turning in your pilot. You know, I always say that turning in your pilot was like driving a new car off the lot. You know, it immediately devalues by 50% the second you send it out. You know, with a novel, it's different because your publishers are generally more tuned into the creative process than, say, a network executive where, you know, ratings and money is just absolutely everything. So, yeah, writing a novel is, or at least for the first two that I've done, has been a complete pleasure.
Well, I love hashtag me as well, and I think that anybody that enjoyed your work on Seinfeld would love it. And is that a part, I don't know, is that, does that come into your head? That is, when you wrote your Seinfeld episodes, you knew that millions of people would watch them, and you hope that millions of people will read this novel, but there's no guarantee.
Yeah, there's absolutely no guarantee, and, you know, millions of people don't read anything unless, you know, it's, you know, 50 Shades of Grey. You know, how do you get millions of readers, you know? While on Seinfeld, you were pretty much guaranteed to get 35 million people watching.
Even if the episode was bad and everyone hated it, like the finale or something.
Yeah, here you're thinking in the thousands, you know, and I think if you're going to write novels, you really better enjoy the process of actually writing the novel, because so much of the rest is out of your control. You know, you can do what you can do. You can try to get people to read it. But, you know, the best part is the part that you have control over, which is sitting down and writing it. So it's really important to enjoy that.
Do you have another one on the way?
No. At the moment, I don't. I'm kind of just thinking of them. But I do have one that I had already written that I felt like something wasn't there. So I put it aside, and I've come back to it a little bit. And I think I'm going to try to get that one in perfect shape and send it out. It's a complete departure. It's about a girl who, a girl in the South who is kind of from, you know, rednecky parents. You know, her father is a sheriff and, you know, her mother is a faded beauty queen, and she's in high school, and she happens to know for a fact that in a previous life she was Sigmund Freud. And she remembers everything about being Sigmund Freud, and she is constantly talking kids off this ledge. There's like a suicide attempt epidemic in this school, and they constantly call her to talk these kids off this ledge. And she doesn't want to do this stuff. She remembers being Freud and thinking it was kind of a miserable life, just dealing with everybody's problems all the time. And in this life, she just wants to have fun. And yet, you know, she's got this obligation somehow to save people. So it's a struggle between being who you want to be and being, you know, a slave to your own talents. And, you know, I think it's kind of a girl power novel in a way, you know, where it's about a girl who wants to live her own life. And it's, you know, pretty fantastical, obviously. And I really enjoy it, and I'm thinking, like, I'm going to polish that one up and try to get it out there next.
It sounds wonderful. And with great power comes great responsibility.
Exactly, exactly. Who said that originally?
Stan Lee. That's Peter Parker's.
Oh, right.
Peter Parker's motto.
Right.
The thing I love about hashtag me as well is that there's a laugh, at least one laugh on every page, and yet I really feel it's a serious drama, even though it's very, very funny and enjoyable. And I think Everybody should read it. Hashtag Me As Well, a novel. The author is my guest, Peter Millman. Peter Millman, thank you so much for spending some time talking to us on From the Bookshelf.
Well, thank you so much for having me. It's really great to talk to somebody who remembers, you know, the Levi's plotline in a Sponge-worthy episode. Very rare.
That's it for this week's From the Bookshelf. I hope you enjoyed the program and will come back and see us again next week. In the meantime, check out our podcast page at fromthebookshelf.com. I'm Gary Shapiro. Thanks for listening.